Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Jones! Bowden! He's got it! England have won the World Cup by the barest of margins!
Stokes flashes it away through the covers for four, and England have won the match!
Hello and welcome to the Analyst Inside Cricket. Those great commentary moments, well, there were a few more today. They didn't favour England particularly, certainly not at the end of the day. We're talking about this programme, Simon, as a sort of Ashes review. It feels, after the second day's play in Melbourne, like an Ashes post-mortem, almost, because England's hopes are hanging by a thread now, 31 for 4.
Yeah, they're just about done, I think, in this Ashes series. I think we all sensed that that was going to happen, certainly after Adelaide, the first few days in Adelaide. We realised which way that game was going to go, and it seems fairly obvious which way this game is going to go as well. England didn't bowl badly today. I mean, they got themselves back in the game, but we still felt Australia had too many. That lead of 82, and then there was that perfect hour, the crowd behind them, and I thought Stark and Cummins were excellent, perhaps especially Cummins. Stark picked up a couple of wickets. Actually, Cummins didn't get a wicket. And then Scott Boland, wouldn't you know, chipped in with a couple at the end. But it was gladiatorial from Australia. And they fed off the crowd as well, and they fed off the match situation. And it was actually thrilling cricket. It was an amazing experience to be there in that last hour. The crowd was so noisy. It wasn't a huge crowd in. I think the official attendance was around about 30,000 today. But they got so involved in that last hour, and England, you know, they've still got Stokes and Root there, and they've lost one of the wickets as a night watchman. But it's hard to see them getting out of this on this surface. There's enough there for the bowlers, and England were able to exploit that today to bowl Australia out.
Yeah, I mean, there is a lot in the wicket, as you say. It reminds me of a pitch like Headingley in the 1980s, but a quicker version, where the ball, if you get it on the right length and line, it jumps, it seams, it does things unpredictably, and it's not an easy pitch to stay in on. And actually, the Australians did, I think, in the end, pretty well to get 267. There were a few moments, I suppose, where England could have capitalised on breakthroughs, and they'll look back on, you know, one or two kind of decisions to bowl certain people at certain times. And I think also, you know, brilliant though Jimmy Anderson was again, 4 for 33 in 23 overs, amazing figures. I still think England could try and bowl a bit fuller still. You know, I heard Ian Chappell saying on TV, if you get the batsman driving and he drives three fours and then gets out, I'll take that, 1 for 12. And there were still not many balls that he tried to induce the drive. A classic example, Steve Smith's wicket. You know, Steve Smith loves just sitting on the back foot, waiting for the ball to come to him and knocking it around on either side of the pitch. As soon as you try and bowl a bit fuller, he's just a bit slower getting out of the blocks. And he was on the move to that ball from Anderson, which nipped through the gate. It was a good ball, obviously, nipped through the gate, got the inside edge and onto off stump. But, you know, just being hypercritical, there were still not enough balls in that area from England. If you look at, for instance, the Australian lengths in the first 10 overs that they bowled compared to England's lengths in the first 10 overs, there's a lot more short balls from England in their opening burst. And it's those 10 overs that really dictate the course of an innings. And look at what's happened today in that last session. 12 overs from Australia, 4 wickets, and almost every ball. I mean, Stark, as you say, wasn't absolutely on the money, but Cummins, you know, every ball is asking a question. Every ball is demanding a stroke. Most balls are foolish and drawing the batsman forward. There was that horrible snorter to Hamid, which took off from just short of a length and flew at his head. And that's the kind of ball that, you know, really gives a batsman tremors on pitches like this. But generally, Cummins doesn't use a short ball very much. He just keeps on probing away, trying to hit the top of off stump. And actually, to Scott Boland's credit, he did that in that one over he was offered at the end of the day. He hit the top of off stump. And that's where Australia have been that little bit better, bit quicker and a bit fuller.
If you'd been captain, you wouldn't have bowled Scott Boland for that over, would you?
No, that's true, actually. I agree. I mean, Stark and Cummins had created such a menace between them. And Stark got the two wickets. He was the lesser of the bowlers, really, but got the two wickets. Two good balls that got the wickets. The one to Zach Crawley, which he kind of had to play, but Stark wasn't getting his normal in-swing. And I think Crawley was done by just the angle. And that was a good ball. He had to play it. And then the next ball just did David Malan for pace. And a marginal LBW decision. I would have given that not out, I think, as a standing umpire because of the bounce. It just was clipping the top of leg stump. So unlucky for Malan. You could see from his walk-off, he did feel he was a bit hard done by there. But actually, I would have given Stark another over just because he poses such a threat. And in a way, even if he's bowling badly, he still produces wicket-taking balls. But, you know, credit to Cummins. He went for the local man and he delivered.
Yeah, Milan, that LBW decision, it was just shaving the top of middle and leg stump. It did feel like a marginal one. But there was, people say, well, Australian umpires, you know, DRS, it favours Australia, even though you've got the DRS. You know, if you give it out on the field, then the umpire's call, it goes with the umpire. But there was one earlier in the day where Leach's wicket was an umpire's call. That was given out by one of the Australian umpires as well. One was Blocker Wilson and the other one was Paul Rifle. So, you know, there were two marginal LBWs, one in each innings, and England got the benefit of one. They didn't get the benefit of the other. So, you know, no quibble there whatsoever. Marcus Harris today battling, and you look at the scores in the match, I mean, it's perverse, isn't it? A player who's looked really scratchy, vulnerable, you feel he could almost be out any ball. He's the player, actually he's the player of the day, and it looks as if he's played close to a match-winning innings. He sort of held everything together for Australia. Didn't look particularly pretty, but he battled out for 189 balls for his 76. I mean, no one in this pit match, apart from, I think, Joe Root in the first innings, has looked in on this surface, has looked secure. Root did look secure in the first innings and had a waft outside the off stump and nicked one behind. But no one looked particularly secure for Australia today. It was really hard work. And there's that thought in the back of your mind, if England could have, it doesn't look as if it's going to happen now, could have set Australia 180 to win, then, they might be in the game, but it looks beyond them, unless something quite miraculous happens. It's hard to see England setting Australia more than about, 70 or 80, something like that. That's what it feels like overnight. Still Root there, still Stokes there. They've got that quality, but this there's enough in the surface for the bowlers to cause England some problems and just sort out that middle order tomorrow.
And they just make it happen that bit quicker. Certainly Cummins and Stark do anyway. It just skips off the surface.
I think that's the difference, Joz. You know, we talked about England. You know, could they have restricted Australia to under 267? Australia were able to sort of chisel it out. But Australia have got that extra bit of pace in their attack, which it does it a bit quicker. And that's why England are under a bit more pressure. Well, also, I think there's the quality of the batters generally as well, and they're not in form, et cetera, but I think that, Australian bowlers, for example, Adelaide, all of Australia's pace bowlers at Adelaide were quicker than any of the England bowlers. It was Australia's block, four bowlers, and then England's five bowlers below them. And so they have got that extra pace.
And of course, Mark Wood playing in this match, and he did get the ball through, one or two balls around 90-odd. Well, over 90, actually, 150 kilometres an hour, so that's, 93 or something. I mean, great effort from Mark Wood. He was unlucky. Harris stuck it out. It was pretty scrappy. The Aussies are very good at actually lower-order players as well, just picking up 20s, Stark, Cummins, crucial little extra runs, nearly 50 runs from that last couple of wickets. I think it was, 219?
Yeah, 219
for eight. The eighth wicket fell. So 267, nearly 50 runs from the last two wickets. Obviously, Nathan Lyon being the night watchman meant everybody was sort of down a place. But still, it's valuable runs, especially in the context of this sort of pitch. I mean, with Wood, great effort from him, as I say, and he perhaps just doesn't have quite the skills. Pat Cummins is one of the best Australian fast bowlers they've ever produced, undoubtedly. I saw Dennis Lilly bowl, who was their leading wicket taker for a long time, and he had the same consistent menace and skill and relentlessness that Cummins has. But I think, if anything, Cummins is even more accurate. And he just get every ball seems to ask a demanding question. With Wood, you know, there's all that effort, there's pace. He hasn't quite got the height that Cummins has, and he hasn't quite got the skill. He doesn't quite do the it's just enough with the ball to take wickets in big batches. He gets wickets, but he doesn't kind of get them in, you know, twos and threes, little sort of gets the best players out consistently enough.
Mm. How about also as well this idea that, yeah, there's only one of him as well. So, you know, psychologically for the batters, they know they can see off a Wood spell. I mean, he did cause some problems. I mean, there's a nasty ball yesterday to Warner where he was flinching and it sort of, you know, turned his head away and it went off the glove and over the slips. And there's one to Green today, something very similar, and he got away with it. And they were two wicket-taking balls, but the batters got away with it. But with Wood, you know there's only one of those, whereas the rest are steady, whereas Australia have got Stark with, you know, pace, they've got Cummins with pace as well. And in the last game, they had Richardson with extra pace, and more pace than the England bowlers. Anyway, it made me think back tonight to just watching that with Stark and Cummins, you know, what it was like when West Indies had four quick bowlers playing in their attack. It made you realise, you know, there is a bit of hyperbole around, you know, well, they bowled like the wind, they bowled at 95 miles an hour, all of them. They probably didn't, but what they did do is they bowled at good high pace, and it was relentless. There were four at you for all of the day.
I think also the pitches weren't great, some of the pitches you played against them on as well. And the other thing is that with the ball coming from that height all the time, with the exception of Malcolm Marshall anyway, you get very little balls to score off. It's hard to drive the ball, at least with Cummins. You know, he's only, what, 6 foot two or something, 6 foot three. So if he bowls full, you can drive. And Joe Root did today, but played a beautiful off drive. And I think so did Hazi Pamid as well. But, you know, with those West Indian fast bowlers, with the extra height, it's hard to drive the ball. So you're not going to get many runs off the front foot. And then, therefore, you're trying to score off the back foot all the time and balls into your ribs all the time. You don't have many options. The boundaries were further back then as well. So, you know, using the fence, I mean, Melbourne is a massive space, isn't it? And in those days, when the West Indies were in their pomp, you know, they would use the full arena. So trying to hook or pull them for fours and sixes was a big risk. So you had very little scoring options against those faster bowlers as well. Are you struggling to get up and out on these dank, dismal days after a sleep-deprived night, hoping in vain for England to produce some fighting spirit? Here's a great solution, Mission Teas. Mission have created a new range of 100% natural performance teas to provide something we all need more of, sustainable energy. They're based on enlivening South American herbs like rooibos and yerba mate. They've become a favourite with professional athletes, including some of the England team. They've certainly helped me get through some of these depressing nights. So whether you're following the Ashes Down Under or not, we think you'll love what Mission offers. So we've partnered with them to give you, the listeners, 20% off your next order. All you need to do is head to missionuk.com, discover the teas you need to fuel your day using Mission's handy quiz, whether you're looking for better energy, enhanced performance or boosted recovery, and enter the code CRICKET20, all one word, at checkout. That's CRICKET20 at missionuk.com.
There are a couple of other things that we need to talk about. One is the delay to the start of the second day. Four people testing positive for COVID within the England camp, a couple of support staff, and, well, in separate incidents actually, one support staff and two from his family, and then another support staff member testing positive as well. So the England players tonight are taking PCR tests, and I suppose in a way that the sort of the fate of the game depends on those. You know, if a few more were to test positive, then what does that mean for this game? they may have to have a look at that. Anyway, that's something for the future. But it, you know, it's so much part of the game. You can have COVID substitutions. How many? It all depends on those tests. Both teams are taking the test. But England did take the rapid antigen test this morning before they were allowed to go to the ground. They were on the bus, and then they were told, "Hold on a second, we've got a problem." And they had to get off the bus, and they were delayed going to the ground. Hence the half an hour delay to the start of the play. And we thought initially when we heard that, we thought, "Oh goodness me, the day's play is going to be called off. Everyone's going to have to stay in the hotel, and who knows about the fate of the test match." So that there is that hanging over the game, and by the time people listen to this podcast, it may be out of date. We may know the results of those tests. Probably won't be known until the morning. So there's that issue that just does hang over the test match. The other thing I wanted to talk about, actually just talk about tactics. There was a passage of play after lunch today where Jack Leach was bowling, left arm round the wicket to the two left-handers, Harris and Head, after lunch. And England had four men on the leg side boundary, or four men out, three on the leg side, one at long off. It was just after lunch. It was a clutch moment in the game. It was 131 for four at lunch. And Jack Leach was bowling, his leg stumped, and the ball was turning down the leg side. It was easy pickings. And I felt England had done really well in the morning session, but they just allowed Australia to get away a bit after lunch. And those two added, they took the score to 171 before the fifth wicket fell. And it was that moment I thought was a really frustrating moment in the day. So if you look at England's bowling effort, if there was one sort of passage of play which didn't work out for them, that was it. And I think they got it wrong. They got it quite badly wrong there. And actually Leach eventually went over the wicket and created an opportunity. There was a missed stumping chance. There was a top edge that went just over a short fine leg. So I think when England look back on their day, yes, good 267 all out, but they could have been just a bit more ruthless. Jack Leach bowling straight after lunch. It felt like a time to bowl your pace bowlers again. I know they bowl a lot in the morning, whatever, and they've got four of them, so you have to mix and match a bit. And Lyon bowls at one end and the Australia rotate from the other, and perhaps that's what they were trying to do with Jack Leach. But it just felt as though they just allowed a pressure release on Australia straight after lunch.
This is England's last chance saloon. And you have to appreciate that every start of a session is crunch time. You've got to strike. Batsmen have got to resettle, recalibrate, start again at the beginning of a new session. So ask them the most demanding questions. Make it difficult for them. Make it awkward. And that little spell from Leach, you're right, just let the pressure off. You've got to think, when you take the field again after a break, who would the batsman least like to face now? And I know it's hard on the faster bowlers who, as you say, have bowled a fair bit in the morning. But if Australia are four down and you strike early after lunch, six down, seven down, you might be putting your feet up in an hour and a half's time. So you've got to keep going with the premier bowlers at the beginning of each session. You definitely don't want to let your foot off the gas. And that's exactly what England did. If you're the two left-handed batsmen on a pitch like this, which is, it feels almost slightly corrugated, the ball is, bouncing a little bit awkwardly and obviously seaming. It's a perfect pitch. It's a seamer's paradise, really. Why are you bowling a spinner straight after lunch? And especially a spinner who is not particularly confident at the moment, bowling to two left-handers who are just working easy runs on the leg side with three men on the boundary on the leg side. So I find these sort of decisions strange because, England, sometimes you can blame a captain for a weird decision in mid-session. But at the beginning of a session, when guys would have had time during the lunch break to discuss who to bowl in that next session, everyone would have kind of given their opinion, but you'd have thought there was a consensus. I don't know why the consensus would be Leach. You've got to think we should be using our most potent bowlers straight after lunch from both ends.
Yeah, and if it was Jack Leach, it had to be Jack Leach, why was he bowling round the wicket with so many men out, especially to Marcus Harris as well? It was like similar fields to Head and Harris. I mean, they did change it quite soon after they brought a couple up. But was Harris going to hit the ball over the mid-on towards long-on, bring that fielder up? I don't know. It just felt wrong. And Jack Leach, if you think if he's going to bowl round the wicket, and there was a bit of turn there, surely you need to bowl an off-stump line. So the ball is threatening the stump, threatening that front pad. If you're just bowling leg stump and it's turning down the leg side with fielders, it's just easy pickings off the hip.
Yeah, and it's also not challenging both edges of the bat either, is it? You know, you're not challenging the outside edge and the potential catch at slip, which Nathan Lyon can be good at. He does get batsmen out called at slip. I don't think Jack Leach very often does get left-handers called at slip because he is that more leg stump line type bowler.
Yeah. Anyway, it was one of those passages of play where just for England lost control of the game. It wasn't a sort of dramatic loss of control in the sense that, you know, it wasn't like loads of runs were scored, but it just felt the pressure was released and Australia were able to sort of inch their way quite comfortably. It was for about 20 minutes, half an hour, inch their way towards England's first innings score and, you know, eventually build the base for that, the lead of 82, which, you know, 82 in some test matches, you know, you can knock it off and you can build a decent score in the third innings. India did that, didn't they? At the Oval Test match, I think they were about 90, 99 behind on first innings and they were able to dig in and overturn the game, made a big score in the second innings. Isn't that sort of pitch? So it felt a moment of release for Australia. But you know, both teams talking afterwards about, you know, the difficulty of the pitch. Harris was saying that, you know, it was a difficult surface to score. And one thing about Harris, actually, he was saying that it was a surface that I'm used to. I'm used to playing in these conditions here. So I did feel, you know, at home to some extent. It wasn't easy. It was really challenging. He said Anderson was really challenging. But he sort of, I suppose he had the confidence of knowing he could play on that surface and just kept going. And they just chiseled it out, really. I mean, from Smith down, all the way down to Stark, who came in at number 10, they all reached double figures. They all did a bit of a job and just cobbled. It was a cobbling together of a first inning score for Australia. And then that, you know, wonderful hour in which to bowl for Australia. And they certainly made the most
and
of it.
And was that another a 51st duck for England, isn't it?
I think it's up to 52 now.
52 with Milan and who else today? Somebody else today.
And Jack Leach, yeah. Jack Leach.
Of course, yeah.
So, yeah, the ducks are mounting up, and you wouldn't put it past England to register a few more on what I think could be the final day. I mean, it seemed fairly clear to me from quite a long way back, you know, even on the first day, this could really be a three-day test match on this pitch, three-innings game or just about. Can England cobble something together in their second inning? Stephen Finn was saying that, yeah, what could England, sort of, with a bit of luck, think about defending. You know, could you defend 130?
You could certainly give the batsman a few wobbles. You could do some damage.
Yeah, you could definitely do some damage. You could make them stress a bit. I mean, it's happened before in Ashes Test matches. Obviously the famous one at Headingley, and also at the Oval in the late 90s when Tuffers bowled them out when Australia, you know, barely chasing about 120 and bowled out for around about 100. So, you know, that's looking on the hugely optimistic side. But, I mean, unless Root plays brilliantly and gets some support from Stokes or Bairstow or Butler, then it looks as if it's going to be a sort of 70, 80 sort of maximum.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose if you think back to that great Headingley test of 81, actually, where Australia were chasing, I think, 130 to win, and they were bowled out for 117, wasn't it? And obviously they had Bob Willis charging down the hill,
111 yards. How can you not remember? England won by 19 runs.
I didn't realise it was 111, actually, but I should have known, shouldn't I, with that superstitious number. But in a way, you know, not dissimilar pitch, actually. That was a pitch where the ball lifted off a length. I mean, it was a bit treacherous towards the end. This Melbourne surface isn't quite like that yet, but you'd need a lot of luck to survive against Pat Cummins with a hard new ball in the morning. I can see him, you know, definitely taking. I mean, he hasn't taken any wickets so far in this innings, and God knows how, really. So he's got a couple almost in the bag in the morning. It's just a question of who and when, I suppose. Can England get another 180 runs to set Australia 130 to win? No, I don't think so. I think too much damage is done. There's too much happening in the pitch, but you never know.
Slight correction. Mea culpa. England won by 18 runs. They were bowled out for 111, Australia. They did need 130, but of course it's 18 runs because they needed the extra run. So, yeah, they needed 19 to win when the last wicket fell. So it was 18 runs.
We're going to have Pushkar and Andrew Sampson boning up, telling you off, aren't we?
Yeah. Yeah. Australia 401 for 9 declared and 111. England 174 and 356. It's going to need something like that, isn't it, to give England the sort of runs they need to try and defend in.
Mark Wood,
in
8 for 45.
Innings. 8 for 43.
Yeah. Well,
Bob Willis back in 1981. We're clutching at straws. It's felt like a tour of clutching at straws, actually, from almost the first ball at that when Stark castled Rory Burns. Burns dropped for this Test match. What about England's top order? We've seen Zach Crawley come into the game. No runs from him, averaging 11. I mean, he didn't demand a recall. It was like a sort of hunch recall, wasn't it? They feel he's capable of getting runs in these conditions on Australian pitches. But this isn't really, as you've mentioned, this isn't really a typical Australian pitch. Mm. And Zach Crawley in this game, 12 and 5. And I mean, he actually did well to get to 5. They did quite well to get to the fifth over. You felt like in those opening overs, there could be a wicket off every single ball. I was talking in the commentary box just off air, and I said to one of my colleagues, "It's going to happen. There's no way there's no way against this intensity of bowling that this opening pair are going to survive." I don't think I expected 22 for 4, but you could see it felt so much like a wicket or two was just around the corner.
Yeah, I feel for both those openers. I don't think there was much they could do about the balls that dismissed them. I mean, Crawley, having had no cricket for however many months, really tough for him. The only opener who's... Well, actually, both Warner and Marcus Harris have made runs in this game as the Australian openers. And, firstly, they're not up against Pat Cummins and Mitchell Starc. And secondly, they've been batting in the series, whereas Crawley hasn't had that luxury. So it's incredibly tough. But there is a reason why Pat Cummins is the best number one test bowler in the world. That's because he's bloody good. And I don't see how either of those batsmen could have resisted, although they both got out to the other end. I don't see how they really could have been blamed for their dismissals.
Yeah, it's almost as if Cummins, with his bowling, had an assist. Do you know what I mean? In football terms, the person that creates the scoring opportunity, Cummins' relentlessness perhaps helps Stark out. That idea of bowling in tandem, which you would have done in your career, where you keep the pressure on for the other bowler and they get the rewards from your bowling. Seems a bit unjust sometimes because there's nothing in your wickets column and you think, he didn't bowl particularly well, and this other bloke, he took a 5 for or 7 for or whatever. But it sometimes works out like that. It is about
it is, and also actually, one can't underestimate the advantage of a left arm over bowler to support a Cummins, who is more conventional in style. But Stark, left arm over, fast, looks to pitch the ball up, tries to swing it into the right handers, but doesn't always get it right. But still, that angle is asking a different question to what Cummins is asking from the other end. So you can't underestimate Stark's value just in terms of his different trajectory and his pace and his total optimism. I mean, what I like about him actually is he runs up and he'll bowl a rubbish opening over, but it doesn't seem to put him off. And he comes charging in again and gradually finds his range and picks up wickets just when they need them.
Well, he's got that experience as well, isn't he? I mean, he's been there and done it. Now, how do we get on with our predictions for the second day's play? Last night I went for close of play score, England 10 for 1, and you went with England 30 for 2. You were so close to being spot
Scott
on.
Ruined my predictions, didn't he?
he ruined it, because when he started that over, it was 22 for 2, and you were nearly bang on. I think we both felt, didn't we, that England could bowl Australia out today. Well, we both said it with our predictions. We felt Australia would get a bit of a lead, but there was enough in the pitch for England to bowl Australia out. So what are we saying? What's going to be our prediction for the third day, Yoz?
I can see England getting another 120 runs, leaving Australia 70. They'll get it for 3.
Yeah. I'm not going to argue much with that. It's that sort of situation, isn't it? I think the most England will set Australia 90, and even that is being optimistic. There may be one or two wickets in it for England, but perhaps not that many. I am going for an 8-wicket Australia victory, and you're going for a 7-wicket Australia victory. So we'll see where we are this time tomorrow when, well, you talked about it being a post-mortem this podcast, Yoz. It's going to be Australia retain the Ashes tomorrow by the looks of it. We're going to have to have another one of those reviews, aren't we? There's normally a review after an Ashes series loss, and you know,
few heads will roll. Normally
sackings and all that sort of thing. But I mean, one of the bottom lines is, and we have touched on it, is about the quality of England's batting and the type of batters they're producing. Mm.
It's a constant talking point, you know, when people come up to me all the time, why are we so bad? I mean, I had my family over for lunch yesterday, Boxing Day lunch, and you know, they're all asking why can't we make runs? And it's a long answer, which probably takes the whole of lunch to explain. You know, fundamentally, it's the organisation and scheduling of county championship cricket, which over the last 10 years hasn't really focused on helping batsmen build long innings or facing fast bowlers or spinners, which is what you have to do in Australia.
Yeah, and there was, you know, there was a focus after the 2015 White Ball World Cup about, you know, what could England do, and they had, you know, they had sort of a real look at it and real emphasis on white ball cricket, and it looks to me as if they're going to have a real think about you know, the red ball cricket in England. I mean, the game is in England is wealthy enough, and there are enough people playing, there's enough support in the game to actually focus on both. Yeah, I don't think one necessarily has to be at the exclusion of the other. You just need to get your structures right and think about the good balance between the two. But I don't know whether that ship has sailed now, whether the, you know, white ball is just going to take over more and more, you know, with all the tournaments we have and the excitement that is generated around white ball cricket, and the fact that England, you know, have got a good white ball side in both T20 and 50 over cricket, and whether, you know, the price that England are paying here is about what has happened recently, I think, in the game. You know, there was a very competent England side from sort of 2000 onwards. Central Contracts helped that, but that sort of quality has really been dissipated. And since the breakup, actually, since Mitchell Johnson broke up that England side in 2013-14, England have not been the same since. And they've been on a sort of like an up and down
roller coaster.
Up and down roller coaster, really, yeah. And it's someone needs to think seriously about how that is amended, because otherwise this sort of thing is just going to go on happening.
Yeah, I mean, it is. Of course, the advantage from an England point of view is that it's happening in the middle of the night and in the middle of winter.
So no one's noticing.
No one really cares. Do they really care? Of course, people who listen to this podcast care. We care. But does the country care, really? I mean, what we want to do is win the Ashes at home. And then it's all triumphalism and so on. I'm not arguing that we shouldn't be focusing on winning them away, but it happens so rarely. Do we kind of upend the apple cart? Do we totally, you know, throw the baby out with the bathwater, to trot out a few cliches, to just so you can win the Ashes abroad? Well, probably not. In a way, in the end, it's the state of your game at home. It's the profitability of your game, the success of your game, and the sustainability of your game at home, which is the main thing. And if you can win abroad in Australia, it's a bonus.
Yeah, well, that's quite a gloomy note on which to end, really, because it says this is just going to happen over and over again. But I think you can... England have started to lose test matches consistently at home, though, as well. So when that starts to happen, then I think people go, hold on a second, is there something we can do here? I don't think we can just sort of shrug our shoulders and say, oh, well, we always lose in Australia. England's record isn't great in Australia. Is there a way to, you know, to challenge teams away from home? And that is the mark of a really good test match team. Obviously, win at home, but can you win away? Can you win in India? Can you win in Australia? Those are the two sort of toughest places to win. Yeah, sure, England can win in South Africa and they can win in Sri Lanka, and they've done that. Although, you know, they've struggled to win in West Indies recently as well. And they haven't been a great test match team for a long time, and England haven't won there for quite a while. I mean, there are flaws, fundamental problems. I think one of them is they're not producing the quality of batter. And also, as well, you know, Jimmy Anderson, he's not going to be with us for very much longer, you wouldn't think, and Stuart Broad as well, and that's taking out 1,000 wickets. And, you know, where are the bowlers coming behind them, and where are the spinners as well? I didn't think we were going to do a sort of overall, we've already done it, but we've sort of touched on it. But anyway, first things first. Let's see what happens on the third day of the MCG test. It's fair to say it doesn't look good for England. It feels as if Australia are about to retain the Ashes. We shall see on the third day. We'll be back with our third day review, possibly our end of test match review this time tomorrow. Thanks very much for listening. Goodbye for now. Podcast Network.